Well, the thing that struck me about Paul Simon's contribution to pop is that he often doesn't get credit for some of the innovations that he brought to popular music, I think, especially in terms of world music and exploring different world musics within an American pop context. I think people think of Paul Simon as a New York guy, you know, maybe now like an Upper East or Upper West Side, you know, turtleneck wearing, hangs out with Mike Nichols kind of guy or something. But in fact, you know, he's always been very, very interested in the wide range of American and world musics. And his music is a lot more varied than people who stereotype him as a folkie would realize. From the very beginning, early on, well, not, okay, let me say that again. From very early on, even in Simon and Garfunkel's career, Paul Simon began exploring Latin music in terms of Simon and Garfunkel songs. He was interested in doo-wop from the very beginning, African-American music, and then, of course, Graceland was such a crucial gesture in bringing African music to the West. Controversial, but crucial. So I think Paul Simon gets a rep because of his sort of persona as being almost kind of a square at this point, when really he's always been an innovator. Well, I've always thought it was very, very important that Paul Simon is from Queens. Queens is both the most diverse urban center in the country, basically, most diverse borough of New York. And also, it's an aspirant borough. People from Queens who want to cross over and get into Manhattan, you know, they're reaching for something. And I think early Paul Simon has that feeling of the aspirant, the good boy, the good student who wants to do well. And the songs are some of the very early stuff, I think Simon would agree, is a bit pedantic, you might say. It's definitely very, very seriously thought out and kind of plods a bit. But I think that desire to always best himself even shows very early on. And then, of course, pretty soon after he started to rise as a pop star, he started to bring in those sort of street influences and different kinds of musical influences that he grew up with in Queens. Can I say something else? Another important thing to talk about when you talk about Paul Simon is his Jewishness. There's so many important American composers who are Jewish, and I think that identity, similar to African-American identity, although different, it gives you an outsider perspective, it connects you with other outsider groups, in a sense, and it makes for the kind of, how do I say it, it's like the kind of step, like slightly outside viewpoint that makes for great songwriting. There's the entertainer tradition, you know, in Jewish culture, the vaudeville tradition, but also there's the home tradition of singing. And in early Simon and Garfunkel, I think you really hear Paul Simon listening to Art Garfunkel, not only as a great pop singer, but as a potentially great sort of cantor, you know? He's got that quality, that choir boy quality, but it's really a quality that comes from going to synagogue, I think, and being connected with Jewish tradition. So that also, the Jewish identity of Paul Simon is an important one to bring up. Paul Simon started his career very young, in the 50s, trying to write basically pop songs, you know, Everly Brothers style songs. But Simon and Garfunkel were both very collegiate, and like an entire generation, they got involved in a kind of existential search. And I think for Simon also, it was very important that Simon and Garfunkel started out, they tried to be a pop duo like the Everly Brothers. It didn't go that well. They were connected to the early folk scene, but that didn't go so well either initially. And Simon took some time, and he went to England and connected with the English folk scene. And I think really that the journey to England is a very important one that that isn't talked about enough in terms of Paul Simon becoming himself, you know. I think going to England, connecting with people like Martin Carthy and other members of the English folk scene, and touring around in cafes there, imbued Simon with an even greater sense of sort of seriousness and perhaps self-seriousness than he had before. And it's then he starts writing songs, you know, like Kathy's Song and these introspective, beautiful songs, and perfecting what became the Simon and Garfunkel turtleneck sound. And, you know, doing his own arrangement of Scarborough Fair, for example, tapping into an English folk tradition and a folk revival scene that of course, was a site or a location for young people really searching their own souls. The Paul Simon songbook recordings are very endearing in a way. They're very serious, you know, and it's just him, and he misses Artie for sure, you know. I mean, Artie just has that beautiful voice that makes everything sound so effortless. And Paul Simon has a nice voice too, but it's not quite the same. But there's a kind of like, I am a great poet, 20-something-year-old effort in those early recordings that I think in retrospect probably make Paul Simon himself cringe. But it's a really, really interesting document of his evolution. The interesting thing about Paul Simon is that he is a great craftsman. You know, nobody writes a pop hook like him. He's great at arrangements. He's attracted to that kind of stuff. And, you know, I think in the early 60s, when Simon and Garfunkel really hit, maybe we weren't listening for that so much in that kind of music. You know, we were listening for serious topics and soul searching and things like that. But even in his most kind of serious songs, you know, I Am a Rock or Sounds of Silence or any of those, you know, Voice of a Generation type songs, they're still great pop songs. They still have wonderful hooks. They still sound amazing, and they still have the best harmonies ever. So that's what makes them important. And I think it's not heretical to say that. And I think Simon himself, later in his career, really wanted to go back, even as early as Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyard. You know, Paul Simon's trying to return to the street corner songs of his youth. And it's my favorite Paul Simon is when he finds the balance between seriousness and playfulness, between entertainment and, you know, poeticism. And that's what makes him so important, I think. In Simon and Garfunkel's career, definitely the Graduate soundtrack, well, you have to talk about The Graduate as a really important turning point for Simon and Garfunkel, both commercially, obviously. And also, Mrs. Robinson is just one of their like essential texts, and I think it's because it's both a very, very playful, almost nonsensical song in some ways, and also somehow manages to get across a very serious emotion, which is the kind of confusion of youth at that time, and almost like the existential. It's funny, it's like existentially dark, even though it's so playful, you know, it's not cynicism, but it's that look on Dustin Hoffman's face in the movie when he's just totally doesn't know what to do, which is so that era. So I think, you know, Mrs. Robinson is a really big song for Simon and Garfunkel, not only as a signature hit, but as an artistic move. You know, Mrs. Robinson initially was supposed to be a song called Mrs. Roosevelt, and Paul Simon was writing about kind of what was lost from the FDR era, or what was lost from the era before the 60s, or the many eras before the 60s. So thus the Joe DiMaggio lyric and all that kind of thing. And when Paul wasn't producing enough material for The Graduate, Mike Nichols said to him, "Dude, what are you doing? You got to deliver." And he said, "Well, I have this song. What do you think?" And that's when they twisted it around and made it into Mrs. Robinson. So I think the soul of that old song is what makes it a lasting song and what makes it have impact beyond the film, you know, because to me, the signature line in Mrs. Robinson is, "Where did you go, Joe DiMaggio? A nation turns its lonely eyes to you. Woo, woo, woo." And that survives from the earlier version of the song, which wasn't about Mrs. Robinson at all. It was about Eleanor Roosevelt, and that sort of sense of America is changing, we are losing something, even as we gain something, is really what, to me, makes the song have, you know, it's what's the meat of the song. It's an interesting viewpoint coming from a 60s icon, because in a sense it's a somewhat conservative viewpoint, you know, it's like we're losing something by having a counterculture, by having a revolution, a youth revolution. Or do we really want to give all this up? But I think that's something that Simon brings to the table. I mean, I think his sensibility, for whatever reason, connects him to 50s music in a way, and even older music, that some of his peers didn't always make that quite so explicit. And so he was a great artist to bring the counterculture to the mainstream. And now I'm getting into something else, so I don't know if you want to make this a different question or whatever, a different quote, but I have a whole line about how that's why Simon and Garfunkel are important, you know. Simon and Garfunkel did something that, I mean, I don't think Bob Dylan did it in the same way. I don't think Hendrix did it in the same way, or Janis Joplin, or many of the great heroes of the 60s, which is that Simon and Garfunkel were the counterculture heroes that your parents could listen to and the kids could listen to. They really brought the counterculture to the suburbs, in a sense. And that's not to disparage them or say that they were, you know, like more soft or more sold out or something than say Dylan or something. They had the ability, and Paul Simon has the ability in his songs to state the messages of youth in a language that goes beyond the vernacular of youth. Let's put it that way. So the songs had a different and much wider impact, in a sense, than a lot of his peers, a lot of their peers. And also just the beauty of Simon and Garfunkel's voices together, I think, was really so attractive to many people that to have them be the sort of the pop voice of the counterculture, it's a very important role that they played. One aspect of the early Paul Simon songbook that I really like is that he can write these songs that almost sound like children's songs. There's like a song like At the Zoo, for example. It's such a silly little song. You could really sing it with your 5-year-old, you know? But it's also a perfectly crafted slice of American life. And there's always just a little tiny bit of darkness underneath these songs, too. One song that I really like is called Punky's Dilemma. It's on the Graduate soundtrack, and it's not one of the better-known ones. It's very kind of nonsensical. I think he's like, wish I was a bowl of cornflakes or something. And yet, it really, it's just as powerful a snapshot of early 20s angst as, you know, some really heavy Sylvia Plath poem or something. It's just coming from a different place, you know? It's that ennui that kids can feel. And I love the way he can do that. I love the way in those more playful, more kind of hipster, you know, like I'm going to use the language of hipsterism to just say I'm feeling groovy. That's another great song, the 59th Street Bridge song. You can't help but want to sing that song. And it does seem kind of like, I guess the language could seem a little dated, but with that incredibly infectious melody and the use of the words, it's almost like a little Zen poem or something, you know? It's like, slow down, you move too fast. It's a very simple message. It's said very elegantly, and it's said in a way that's very light. And I love the lightness of those early Paul Simon songs. Well, I'm not the first person to say that, you know, like Duncan is one of those Paul Simon songs. If that was the only song, if Duncan was the only song Paul Simon ever wrote, he would have made this amazing contribution, because it's so plain and so modest in a way in its statement, but it's like a Saul Bellow novel or an Updike novel in just one song. You know, there's so much in it, in its spareness. And I think that's one side of what he can do. He can write that, he can create this little window into the life of an ordinary man. But talking about other songs on that record, like Mother and Child Reunion, which was maybe the first, I don't like to label things the first because it's always dangerous, but one of the very first American songs to bring in like a Jamaican flavor or reggae flavor. And the lyric is one of those silly Paul Simon lyrics. But you know, when you're 12, you think it's really deep. And then you find out it's about something he read on a Chinese restaurant menu. But just that and Me and Julio on that record, I think, show like, look, I'm opening the door. I'm opening the door to all of America, to all of the world in terms of music and sound. He'd done it already with Simon and Garfunkel with Cecilia, for example. Yeah, and the boxer like letting in different sounds, different like Latin American rhythms and structures, and what's it called? You know, I Wish I Was a Sparrow. With that one. But yeah, I mean, so he'd done it before. He'd open up that door, but I think on his early solo work, Simon showed a great determination, especially actually the second record. Still, There Goes Rhyme and Simon is the second one, right? So that second record, which I think he made largely in Muscle Shoals, is that right? In an interview that Paul Simon gave in 1973, he was asked, like, why did you record? You recorded most of There Goes Rhyme and Simon in the South. And he said, musicians, always for musicians, wherever the musicians are, that's where I go. And I think that's in a way that's the ruling statement of Simon's, solo career. He is one of those guys who truly cares about and respects his collaborators and wants to seek out the best collaborators from around the world and wants to seek out new sounds by being a traveler. And those early records, not everybody thinks about them in the same way as they think about Graceland, for example, or Rhythm of the Saints. But they too are really, you know, they are making connections that came to define what we think of as world music, or certainly what we thought of as world music or world beat, you know, in the 80s and the 90s. And I just think it's a gift that he's given American ears to connect both with our own traditions like gospel and New Orleans music and with world traditions. You know, in his many roles, you know, Paul Simon has had many roles within pop. His career's, you know, he's worn a lot of hats, a lot of golf caps. But one of them, of course, is like hybridizer and bringing in world musics. One of them is sort of voice of a generation, countercultural hero. But there's also this period where Simon becomes the quintessential New Yorker, the same way that Woody Allen is the quintessential New Yorker. And I think the 70s is still crazy after all these years, you know, even into One Trick Pony. He's playing that role of the kind of upper middle class, cosmopolitan, Jewish, intellectual. And if for nothing else, those records are incredible documents of a period of time in American urban culture and intellectual life. Some of the songs on Still Crazy capture sort of the whole essence of relationships during that time. You know, everybody's going to a shrink, everybody's going through divorces. You know, that is what those records are about. And when I'm, you know, when someone's looking back in 100 years and to say, just the way that you look at Edith Wharton or something to understand, you know, turn of the century New York, you can look at Paul Simon, those records, and understand turn of the 70s New York. Well, gosh, how did you talk about Graceland? It's so complicated. I think, you know, the first thing about Graceland, before we get into the music, is sort of the scandal of the record initially, which he had to overcome, which I'm sure felt totally unfair to Simon, and in some ways was totally unfair. But because he recorded in South Africa, he was breaking the boycott of the country and working with the South African musicians. Now he, in my mind, rightly, and I think history has proven him out, thought it's more important to get these voices out there than to uphold sort of political rules. But he did have to deal with a lot of protest. And I think, you know, South Africa was such a hot button issue on college campuses in the 80s and really was what the center of a lot of activism was. So Simon, being Paul Simon, approached the subject of South Africa as a musician, you know, not as a humanitarian or as an activist or as a celebrity looking for a cause, but really as a musician. And that's the ultimate gift of Graceland, is that it brought a whole new audience to, you know, Ladysmith, Black Mambazo, and the other great South African musicians who are on that record. But he had to deal with the fact that some people saw it as a kind of colonialist move. And I think that was a really personally a very difficult thing for him. And it was a challenge that the art had to overcome. One thing about Paul Simon's music that you know, purists can sometimes find fault with is that, you know, he, when he makes these kind of hybrids, he doesn't, he puts his own voice on it. You know, he, the songs are still about Paul Simon characters. They're not, you know, I think to his credit, he's not trying to write from the viewpoint of, you know, someone in a township or something like that. And I mean, I say, thank God, but a song like, you know, You Can Call Me Al, it uses that incredible beauty of the buoyant rhythms and the buoyant vocal lines of South African music to tell a story that's just like essential Americana. And so that is a really interesting artistic choice that takes some guts and, you know, ruffles some people's feathers. The title track of Graceland always affects me because I think at the time in the early 80s, I was going through a very intense Elvis fixation. So, you know, the fact that he was capturing kind of the Elvis fixation that we all, many of us anyway, share, and the sort of, you know, the idea of a pilgrimage, I think there's a sense that that record itself is a pilgrimage. And the playfulness with which the pilgrimage happens in the title track, even though there is a seriousness beneath it too. Here he's traveling with his daughter and there's like Here he's traveling with his son and you know, there's a question of like broken marriages in there and he's trying to redeem himself by making this pilgrimage. It's something a lot of people have tried to do and it can be a very sad journey, but he makes it into a joyful journey, and it's really classic Paul Simon. I think for me the impact of Graceland was not so much individual tracks, although I love the hits, but it's just the kind of the sound of it. And it was a time, you know, that the period of time when Graceland came out was a time when a lot of Americans, including myself, were starting to explore and discover African music. King Sunny Ade and Fela Kuti and the music of Ladysmith Black Mambazo. And, of course, through other artists like David Byrne and Brian Eno, there were explorations happening. And so it was exciting to have that sound on the radio in the most mainstream places, even if it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like an authentic quote unquote or whatever you would call it. You know, it wasn't like they were playing actual tracks from township groups on American radio, but just felt like it was opening up the world a little bit.